Hey,
what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah, brother, like, stop. Right on.
There's too many of you crying. Brother.
All right, welcome back to What's Going On with Earl Ingram. And as we head towards the end of 2025, it's still pretty amazing to me that we are almost through a quarter of this century. That's so mind-boggling to me. And speaking of being a quarter of the way into another century, my good friend Sandy Williams is back in the saddle again. Good morning to you, Sandy.
And I keep finding myself slipping and using the term 19 to preface the year we're in. So it's 25 years and I'm still trying to get used to the 21st century, but here we are.
You know, Sandy, it is just unbelievable. It seems like yesterday that I was looking forward to partying like it was 1999.
Yeah, and that was the future.
Yes, that was the future.
Yeah.
But yeah. Needless to say, we are here. And, been fortunate and blessed to have been able to have good contact with you, my friend, for another year. Great content, great conversations, and today is not going to be any different. We're going to talk about, you know, the judicial system, the inner workings of it. And I can't think of anybody any better than to have this discussion and conversation with than you, my friend Sandy. The judicial system is pretty broad based, and I know about the Supreme Court. I know about, you know, the local judges and the state judges and all of that. But we're going to have an in depth conversation with you about the way that system is all set up. So without any further ado, I'll kind of turn it over to you. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, what brought this to mind was my twin sister's married to a fellow who's been a noted American history professor for an entire career. And every once in a while, we just talk about things, you know, what's going on in the world, what does he think? And most recently, what he wanted to talk about is the extent to which he's concerned that from a history standpoint, our judicial system and our legal system is being tested so completely at this point, and his concern is that that it won't ever be the same, that the judicial system, the way it's being tested and the way it's reacting to the tests are such that it could lose its current image and its current capacity to operate in the same fashion that it has in the past. And the thing that is most poignant about it is an example of history. Back in the 1830s, when Andrew Jackson was president, there was a lawsuit involving the state of Georgia and the rights of the Cherokee Indians in the state of Georgia. And the state of Georgia, there was a treaty that had established rights of the Cherokee Indians, and the state of Georgia was ignoring those rights and was trampling on them. And the case went to the Supreme Court, and Justice Marshall ruled in favor of the Cherokee Indians. And the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Cherokee Indians, and Judge Marshall wrote the decision. And supposedly, Andrew Jackson's reaction to that was, well, Justice Marshall has spoken. Now let him enforce his order. And the irony there, of course, is that the Supreme Court has no method for enforcing its own orders. Enforcement of the orders is really required to be carried out by the executive branch. Andrew Jackson ignored the order. The federal government ignored the order. And 7 years later, the Trail of Tears that had the Cherokee Indians evacuated, moved out of Georgia and moved to Oklahoma occurred. And so ever since then, the Supreme Court has understood that it doesn't have this power of enforcing its orders, and therefore it has been careful about the extent to which it exercises its power in a manner in which it might not be able to enforce. And I would say that that precedent brought forward to today has been possibly had a chilling effect on the capacity of the current Supreme Court to act aggressively, to act quickly, and to act effectively in taking up the cases which are now being presented to it as the result of the broad reach of for power that the current administration has taken. And we can talk about it later, but I would say the tariff case is a primary example of this, and the effect of the Supreme Court being unable to cope with or necessarily quickly react to the actions of the executive branch is going to have an impact on the way the public at large views the capacity of the courts in general to solve their problems.
So, Sandy, before we go any further, what you just said about the decisions that were made about the Cherokee Indians and by the Supreme Court back then, and the Supreme Court not really having the power to enforce it. Has it always been then that depending on who was in the White House, that the president would certainly had the ability to disavow, or was it the Congress disavow the decisions that was made by the Supreme Court?
Well, like I said, the Supreme Court doesn't have an army. It doesn't have a police force. It doesn't have anything in its that reports directly to it to enforce its orders, particularly as the orders relate to another part of the government itself. There are ways for courts to enforce their orders with respect to civil matters, and the civil litigants, the plaintiff who wins a lawsuit, is in a position to enforce the order himself through courts and through the power of the court to affect the actions in our civil society. But when you get to matters that relate to the power of various parts of the government, enforcement is basically to be carried out by the executive branch. And so you had Dwight Eisenhower using the National Guard to enforce the Brown v. Education decision back in the 50s. And basically, it's been up to the executive branch to enforce the orders. There haven't been many circumstances in which the executive branch has simply turned its head and ignored judicial orders, but some of that is because the Supreme Court has been careful not to issue orders which it expects might get ignored, which would then prove its impotence. And so I'm concerned that in today's situation, the way our Supreme Court is behaving in the face of all these executive branch actions, for instance, the imposition of tariffs, which seems to run directly against the constitutional provision that tariffs and taxes are to be implemented by Congress. Some of the reason for the slowness of the Supreme Court could have issued an injunction at the beginning of the lawsuit that was brought almost immediately upon the imposition of the tariffs. But of course, an injunction, which is an order by the court not to implement the law or not to carry out the action that they are enjoining, requires someone to enforce it. And so I'm concerned that one of the reasons that they didn't grant an injunction to keep the status quo as it was before the tariffs were implemented until the legality of the tariffs could be litigated was the fact that they were concerned that they couldn't enforce the injunction and therefore it might get ignored, which would prove their impotence and would render their power even less. And so what did we have happen? We had massive tariff regimes implemented, which affected not just this country, but affected the world at large, affected the world trade, the organization of the world trade processes, has had massive effects outside our country as well as in our country. It has also caused the people who pay tariffs to pay a tremendous amount of money into the coffers. And this is all happening before the Supreme Court has decided whether or not the president has the power to issue these tariffs. And so by deciding not to issue an injunction and letting something like the tariffs survive for this period of time and have the massive impact they have, puts the court in a position of now, when they decide its legality, having to decide how that they can unscramble the egg that has been so massively scrambled in the process of allowing these tariffs to go forward for a number of months. And that's an example of the extent to which the testing of our courts is really a testing a very fundamental province and a very fundamental linchpin to our society, because it's ultimately the courts that decide disputes. And though obviously we have plenty of disputes in our society, and if the courts are unable to carry out the orders associated with disputes, then maybe they become kind of superfluous.
Andy, you don't exactly paint a very rosy picture on what I guess many Americans have thought was an impenetrable system that our government has, and democracy and all of those things. But if the Supreme Court, which is really the pinnacle, we would think, of our justice system, but also the one place that we could go to solve the myriad of differences that we have in different parts of the state and in this nation. And then you come and say those words, impotent. You know, many of us have thought the Supreme Court was the summit. And that, well, and that our government, the way it's, what gave our government the power to continue to do what it does. And
well, I think what's happened in a number of other countries and over time is that it's long been recognized that courts themselves can decide matters, but then somebody has to enforce the decision, and it's that incapacity to enforce their decisions that is an ultimate weakness of the third pillar of our government, which is the courts, because the courts decide matters, but then they rely upon society at large to honor their decision and to abide by it. And if the society for which they're rendering the decision decides to ignore their decision, then this fundamental weakness of the judiciary is exposed. And so that's really a serious, from the standpoint of historical reflection on how our society operates and how well it operates, how well our courts are able to operate and to reach decisions which solve the problems of society and then get implemented, that's a very fundamental ingredient to a successful society. And it's being put into jeopardy now simply by the fact that we're testing it so many ways and so many times associated with making decisions about, for instance, the power of the other parts of our government, primarily the powers of the executive branch. And the executive branch wields a great deal of power. The executive branch is the commander-in-chief of the military, and it has basically, it's the only branch that has the capacity to enforce its actions.
So, Sandy, let me ask you then, because if the picture you just painted is happening because of the administration that's in office right now, do you think that those, again, Project 2025 and the orchestrators behind this, had planned to challenge this system that we're talking about right now? I mean, it's always been the same. It could have always been challenged by any different administration. Do you think that this exposure of it, its weakness, its fallibility, is because of the group of people who are in control now?
Well, I do think that that the Federalist Society and the people in power in the government today have thought through and understand the weakness of the courts, and the president himself is a very litigious individual, and he understands certainly the power of delay. And one of the issues that we have with our court system is that the United States is very intent on making sure that process is fair, and that everyone gets due process. And due process means basically you have an opportunity to represent yourself. You have people have an opportunity to have their say to the extent they have an interest in a matter. They have an opportunity to have a fair period of time in which to develop their case and to put their best foot forward. And what's happened over time is that the process involved with a litigation in the United States and the U.S. courts has come to take a very long time. And to some extent, justice delayed is justice deferred, right, is justice lost. And particularly when you get down to making decisions about actions of the executive branch, where the action is implemented immediately and the decision about its legality is deferred for many months so that the action is in place for a long period of time, you get to the point where it's very difficult for the court to fashion an order which doesn't create chaos as the result of trying to unscramble an egg which has cooked substantially. And so we have today, for instance, the power to declare war. It's clearly something that's vested in the Constitution in Congress. But presidents have known that rush fires, things that they carry out surreptitiously and quickly, will be accomplished before the question can be raised and the question answered as to whether, one, what they've done is an act of war, and two, whether it was lawful. And so, our foreign policy has been marked for many, many decades by the executive taking matters into their own hands, at least in things which they thought could be brought to fruition quickly, and without Congress's intervention. We haven't had a war declared by Congress for a very long time, and yet we've certainly managed to get ourselves into a number of them. And so that's an example. I think the current situation with tariffs is another example, but there are many, many examples pending with respect to deferred action by the court while a matter has already been implemented. And in a civil lawsuit, one involving you and I, a court would not be reluctant to issue an injunction to stay the matter, to keep it as it is, until the court could decide whether this new action which is being implemented is lawful or not. And yet the Supreme Court is extremely reluctant to issue injunctions against the executive branch because, number one, they have to enforce it. It could get ignored. And so I think the Supreme Court, in it being self-protective about being proven to be impotent, chooses to hide its impotence with inaction.
So, Sandy, you know, again, as a layperson who this is above my pay grade, trying to understand the court system, and I'm sure many who are listening to this feel the same way. So lower courts, they have the power, or they're backed up in order to make their decisions. When they render their decisions, they're backed up by whom? If at the top of the food chain, There's nobody to enforce that. Why on the lower rungs?
Well, in civil matters, the federal courts have the federal marshals, and the federal marshals are not people in a position to carry AR-15s and implement laws in that fashion, but they are in a position to carry out court orders associated with the divestiture of property,
monetary,
et cetera. And so they can settle civil disputes. They can also make arrests of people who need to be arrested and sent to prison. But with respect to making decisions that relate to the power of a government, another government, a state government that is being ruled, which has a ruling against it from a federal court, or another part of the federal government, which has a ruling which it must respond to from a federal court, there's very limited power from the court standpoint to independently enforce that action. And so that's where we get into this issue. I mean, Tom, Dick, and Mary are subject to the jurisdiction of courts and will feel the pain of the court order almost immediately, whether it's in state court and the matter is enforced by a sheriff, or whether it's in federal court and it's enforced by a federal marshal. But when you get into court matters that are deciding the power of governmental jurisdictions, you have a different problem.
So, Sandy, if we can take a little time for you to go through, you know, we get to the Supreme Court, it's the highest court in the land. But local decisions that impact and affect the American people in the area where they live, how is that system comprised? The pyramid as it relates to how this system works.
Well, you have state courts, and state courts decide matters of state law. They don't decide matters of federal law. And so let's just take the state courts.
Hold on, Sandy, before you go any further. So federal law does not outstripe state law?
No, you know, federal law can preempt state law, but if you're alleging that someone has violated a state law, or if you're bringing a civil action that has as its basis a federal matter, a federal law, then you bring that matter before a federal judge. Okay, if you're alleging that someone has violated a state law, something to do with your property here in Wisconsin, for instance, you bring that action in a state court because it's a matter of state law and the states are familiar with and experts in matters of state law. Federal courts are experts in and have ruling, have the power to rule over federal law. And so let's say that I'm asserting you're creating an illegal monopoly. Well, the Sherman Act and the various laws, anti-monopoly acts, are matters of federal law. So you would go to your local federal court, or the court that is local to the defendant that you are suing. You would go to their local federal court and bring a federal action asserting this violation of the federal antitrust laws. And there are in every state districts. In Wisconsin, we have an Eastern District and a Western District. And based on the caseload of the Eastern District, we have more Eastern District court judges than the Western District, which has a lower caseload, than there are federal judges in the Western District. And you get the matter that you're pursuing tried in the district which is local either to the plaintiff or the defendant's case. And that's the jurisdiction of that court. And then the courts hear the case and they rule on it. Now, the case could have been brought against the federal government in some fashion, and you could bring that case in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. And then the question is whether the ruling of the Eastern District of Wisconsin with respect to the power of that federal agency that's being tested, whether that ruling is applicable only in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, or is it applicable nationally? And quite recently, the Supreme Court dealt with that because there had developed a body of law and had created sort of a forum shopping process, meaning that if you had a lawsuit to bring, you'd bring it before the judge who you thought was most likely to rule in your favor in whatever district in the United States, whatever district court in the United States you could make a valid argument for having jurisdiction over the case that you were bringing. And then that district court would issue an order which would have, which the court would assert had national purport, so that it would determine the case that was decided for the whole country at large.
So
the Supreme Court, the case before the Supreme Court was, hey, that's going to be a problem if any Tom, Dick, and Mary federal court around the country can make a ruling that is implemented nationally. Wow, that's giving a lot of power into the hands of a district court judge. On the other hand, if you restrict that ruling to only be in the district or in a state, for instance, then you could have 50 different rulings with 50 different nuances in 50 different jurisdictions around the country that would cause the federal laws to be implemented in a very haphazard way. So that question alone has been an important one. And most recently, the Supreme Court limited the capacity of a local court to make a ruling that had national consequence across the country. Once you have a decision from a district court, you appeal it to the circuit court of appeals that is the circuit in which your district is located. Wisconsin's district court is located in the Seventh Circuit, which hears its cases mainly in Chicago. And so, you know, the appeals are heard. It's a multi-state circuit for the upper Midwest. And the appeal from the district court goes to the circuit court of appeals to decide whether the district court was correct or not correct. And then, if the matter is one which relates directly to constitutional law, or if the matter is one of federal importance and involves enough consequence, the Supreme Court could take it on appeal from the circuit court of appeals. So the circuit court of appeals is the final decision maker for most cases, but on some cases that they go all the way up to the Supreme Court and the appeal is heard there. And
so
the Supreme Court decisions all have national purport.
So Sandy, is this court system breakdown like local municipal courts, state courts, state appellate courts, state Supreme Court, is that Supreme Court pyramid the same way steps?
Yeah.
It's
the same concept. You step one is the trial court. The trial court level for states is normally circuit, what are called in Wisconsin circuit courts. And then they have a court of appeals in Wisconsin. And then from the court of appeals, you go to the Supreme Court for the ultimate appeal decision. At the federal level, the district courts are the trial courts. They're the ones who hear trials and have juries sitting in the trials. The Court of Appeals simply takes the record from those trial courts and decides whether the trial court interpreted the law correctly. And so they basically are interpreters of the law and hear the appeal from based on allegations that the trial court, the district court, made errors. And the Supreme Court sits on top of the circuit court to ultimately decide what is the law of the land, the correct law of the land. If the circuit courts are in conflict with one another, or if it's a constitutional matter of great importance.
So, Sandy, let's say you're a judge, you're in state court, and you make a decision on something, and you're in the city of Milwaukee, and your counterpart in Ashwaubenon faces the same issue, and they make a different decision than the one that the same person does in the city of Milwaukee. Does that then go to the state appellate court or
the appellate. Well, there are a couple of appellate courts, but it goes to the appellate court, and then the appellate court ultimately goes to the Supreme Court. There can be matters of federal constitutional law, because the federal constitution applies everywhere to everything, and federal constitutional law can be applied within state court decisions, and so some state court decisions at the, let's say, a state Supreme Court decision can get appealed to the federal Supreme Court because of the matter of constitutional law which is implicated in it.
You know, Sandy, with the way this system has been created, it is really, you just think about how thoughtful the people were who set this system up. It certainly has worked, and in many instances, people, depending on how decisions have been rendered, in some instances, they say, well, this system is rigged, it's crooked. But if you look at how it's been able to, after all these centuries, been able to kind of hold things together, and now you come to 2025, Sandy, and we see that our United States Supreme Court, which they said should never have been, you know, whether somebody was a conservative or Democrat, that shouldn't have mattered once you got to that level. But here we are, Sandy, where it looks like, you know, people can lean in one way or the other, conservative on the Supreme Court. It was never meant to be that way, was it?
Oh, I think it was. I think that ever since the Founding Fathers, the Federalist Papers, everyone has understood that there were different ways to look at and interpret matters of, for instance, constitutional law. And so you could take today we have this dispute. Should you look at it through the eyes of the founders and or on an originalist basis? What did they intend, in fact, in their mind when they wrote those words? And others would say, no, you have to look at it through modern eyes and apply it as it should be applied in the modern context, as the founders would have intended it if they knew the modern context. And so that's been a fundamental difference in the way laws get interpreted, and particularly the Constitution. Now, there are all kinds of matters where there isn't much difference between a conservative outlook and a liberal outlook with respect to civil matters of dispute, or with respect to implementation of a variety of federal laws. But there can be differences, and there have been differences, for instance, with respect to how it is that administrative agencies establish rules in furtherance of legislation that's been adopted by Congress, and we've had that dispute recently at the Supreme Court. And there's a legitimacy to the difference of opinion that might exist between a conservative ideology and a liberal ideology as they look at those laws. But what's changed is the extent to which the parties might be willing to color way outside the lines. In the executive branch, the White House has an office of counsel, and the counsel is asked to render opinions with respect to the constitutionality of action which the president might contemplate taking. And the norm has been for the presidents to not necessarily reach very far outside the defined boundaries or the understood boundaries and the norms associated with the interpretation of the executive branch powers. And in the context of that norm, there has developed a variety of concepts that allow the president to, for instance, implement executive orders where there is no clear statute that supports it. And the main one that's been established is emergency powers. Something comes up which constitutes a national emergency, requires immediate action, and the president is the person who's capable of immediate action in order to cure or try to ameliorate this national emergency. Now the question is, what constitutes a national emergency? And that's an area where the current administration has decided to color way outside the lines of what has been deemed to be a national emergency in the past. For instance, even with respect to the demolition of the East Wing of the White House, the most recent discussion of that has included the White House asserting that that construction project is a matter of a national emergency and involves emergency powers of the government to protect the safety of the United States.
Yes. Now, nonsense.
There's little discussion of how that could be. I suppose it could involve a bunker that would protect the president in the circumstance of a nuclear war beneath it. I don't know. But the same is true of the tariff power. The declaration was that this was a essentially emergency power, the implementation of the emergency power based on the security of the United States. And that assertion has never been used in the past to defend the power of the president to unilaterally implement tariffs. And the difficulty here is the Supreme Court is then put in the position of having to make a decision about exactly what kind of situation constitutes a national emergency that allows the president to implement such things. And that's, you know, that's use of the judiciary to import upon the executive branch constraints associated with a judgment call about emergency.
Yeah, but Sandy, this goes back to at the top of our discussion where the Supreme Court doesn't have any control to push back on, especially what is taking place right now and all the different decisions that Donald Trump is making. He can just simply ignore what they're talking about.
Well, that's right. I mean, and I think that has been increasingly the case. I mean, the presidents over the last 100 years have issued many executive orders. Franklin Roosevelt issued, I think, over 4,000 of them. Now, he was doing this during the Depression, which involved lots of national emergencies, as well as during World War II, which was sort of the definition of a national emergency. But, you know, in the modern presidents have resorted to the use of executive orders, and many of them have been tested by the courts. I think everyone who's been watching has observed the slowness with respect to which the courts can respond, and to the extent that executive power is asserted in the name of national emergency, it's been clear that the courts have been very, very slow to intervene and to second guess the president on that score. And I think the current administration and its counselors witnessed that and understood that they might get a far, far more latitude in their conduct if they simply assert national emergency and security as the rationale for essentially all of these executive orders or these actions which seem to be outside the bounds. So that,
Sandy,
what happened now is that the impotence of the court to enforce its own orders is being, I would assert, kind of exploited by the executive branch to expand its powers.
Okay, Sandy, I'm pretty ignorant. So when we talk about the Supreme Court,
oh, don't sell yourself short.
No, I mean from the perspective of the way I thought the system worked. I thought that the Congress would have an opportunity, that they had some authority to be able to stop some of this forward movement that we're seeing taking place with the White House today. And if they couldn't do it, then the Supreme Court could do it. But what I'm seeing, Sandy, is it doesn't look like either can do anything, and that we've always had the possibility of whoever is the president to be a dictator.
Well, Congress does have powers, obviously, including the power of impeachment. I mean, were they to enact a law, and were the president to absolutely turn his back on that law and refuse to honor it, that would certainly be grounds, if it were an important matter, would certainly be grounds for impeachment. Then the question is, how do you enforce the impeachment? But
right.
That ends up being a question, really, that would be related, I suppose, to the extent to which the president could expect or not expect to have his orders over the military. I mean, when you get down to a conflict between the constitutionally based Congress and the constitutionally based president, at that point you're in the potential for a putsch, right? I mean, you're now in a situation where if Congress impeaches the president, he's impeached, unless I suppose he orders the military to do something and they honor his orders, and that's really what you call sort of banana republic. We'd be in the circumstance then of the wild and woolly third world sort of country. But I would expect that Congress could be doing things today, and they could be imposing their will, but they are not. And it's not because they can't, and it's not because they don't have the power to do it. It's because they don't have the will to do it.
You know, Sandy, I'll tell you, This conversation solidifies in the minds of many that our government is, you know, as much as we talk about, you know, the greatest democracy and the oldest democracy and the stability of our nation, it's very fragile. Even with the systems that are already in place and that have been in place, and again, from what we're seeing, you know, there's another 3 years, possibly.
I think that to get away from talking about this administration and simply talk about trends, I would say that what's happened is that the frustration of the American public with the inefficiency of government generally, the ineffectiveness of Congress to be responsive to them, the inability of the government to deal with, for instance, health care and its mass and its rapidly rising costs and what that has done to families and their access to health care. I would say that there has been a frustration that's developed with the current operation of our government as status quo that gave the country an appetite to try something different by electing someone who was a self-announced iconoclast, someone who was going to behave differently. And our government in the past has been premised on honoring norms and staying and restricting conduct to something within the range of the norms. And what happened with, I think, the last election was that the people elected decided that the public was saying, let's throw the norms out. Let's see what we can accomplish in a system which isn't ridden by and restricted by the parameters of the norms. And so that's what we have.
Yeah, we've soon
and
found out that that's
question,
been even
how
worse.
How long will the American public be comfortable with the operation of a system which is operating outside of norms and constantly stressing itself from within by requiring constant judicial review of what the norm or what the law is that constrains this operation?
You know, Sandy, you and you know, being you know, an attorney and well learned and processes and all of those kinds of things, the average American citizen, we see, Sandy, is our government's not working. We elect people, and yet things don't change for us. They get worse. And the only option we have is to replace the person that we put in office. And sometimes that's 2 years, depending on whether it's Congress or the Senate or whether it's the presidency of the United States or whether it's local government. And so we lose faith in government.
Well, I mean, isn't one reaction to losing faith in government replacing the government with a person, someone who was going to exert great authoritarian power and to take government onto themselves and to implement things directly, you know, completely impatient with process, throw process out the window and let's just get things done, okay? That's really, I think, the message that was sent during the last campaign leading into this current administration. I'm going to throw process out the window and I'm going to get things done.
Okay? Sandy,
now that's a compelling case to be made for someone who is impatient about let's get things done. Let's make things happen. But now the question is, what is getting done? What is happening? And how comfortable is the public with it? And how comfortable are they with the process that puts things totally out of reach and totally into the hands of a person who is going to now get things done?
You know, Sandy, I agree with you. I just believe that people had no concept of the as you always talk about, the ingredients that were in the cake that were being baked. If they would have understood exactly what was taking place, many of the people who voted for this administration, they would have even said, well, this is, you know, worse than even what we're dealing with now. And you can kind of see signs of it, Sandy, but, you know, the system is not exactly perfect. It's never been perfect. And so, again, the only thing that we can do as the American people is to replace the people who are running it. And
well, you know,
go ahead.
Yes, but I think that the extent to which the American public was fed up with the system has been underestimated. And I think that the current administration rode that frustration into office and is implementing what they think is the directive they have, which is to throw process out the window and get things done. Now, the problem is that the American public didn't really spend much time, and the campaign didn't really spend much time talking about all the things that were going to get done. I mean, yes, there was mention of tariffs, and there was, of course, mention of immigration. Those are the two things that were talked about. Almost nothing else was talked about. And then the question is, how does it feel? What is the situation that is created by the things that have gotten done or are getting done absent process? And I think that at some point the American public is going to say, you know what, we want to elect people who are going to get things done, but we've got to make sure there's a process that doesn't create the environment in which things get done in spite of us. And in spite of what we want or in spite of what we need. And that's the problem with most authoritarian governments, is that as you get more authoritarian, the people have to rely on a benign paternalism, like, okay, this leader is going to take care of my interests because they're going to take care of my interests, instead of they're going to take care of my interests because I'm going to make sure they take care of, and we're going to make sure they take care of our interests. And so, you know, the American founding fathers were familiar with this problem, wrote a constitution that tried to deal with it, but they weren't really, thinking that the leaders of this country would decide to act contrary to the process and contrary to the norms and to essentially throw process out the window.
So let me ask you, Sandy, then, let's say the next time around the other side of the coin gets control, and they start moving unilaterally like this side has. What does that do long term for the government, and how can it be fixed? Because the other side has to now come back and swing the pendulum back the other way. Are we in a forever changing dynamic of our government? And historians will point out at this point in time the damage that's been done.
Well, I think what would happen if a liberal were to get elected and were to continue to seize the levers of power in the same fashion as the current executive, that you would end up with a fresh memory on the part of those who were on the liberal side of the coin about what it was like and what it felt like to be in a country that was led by a right-wing authoritarian. And those on the right would get a similar experience and be similarly upset by their experience when those same levers were being used by the left. And I think what would happen then would be a rather unanimous view from the right and the left that the Constitution, as it was being interpreted and as drawn, was not adequate and that it needed to be revised. And I think that, and my brother-in-law, the historian, also thinks that this could well lead to constitutional revisions, a retinkering with what the Founding Fathers wrote. And there are some prominent thinkers, some prominent constitutional thinkers today, who think that one of the main problems with the Constitution has been the difficulty we have in amending it. You know, it was drawn to make it very difficult to amend. It has been difficult to amend. And as a result, we're left with large portions of the Constitution, which were written several hundred years ago, in a time frame and in a situation which was quite different from modern America.
Well, you know, Sandy, I've always heard that the Constitution is a living document, and that, you know, to say that it can't be or shouldn't be amended, I think it's kind of foolish.
Well, I mean, but the amendment process is very difficult. So it requires several stages. It requires a bunch of statehouse conduct. It's purposefully made difficult. The talk when we were growing up during the period of the Frankfurter Court and when the Earl Warren, what was viewed as a liberal court, the criticism of that court was that they said they thought the Constitution was a living document, meaning that it needed to be interpreted through modern eyes, and it needed to be interpreted in a manner which was consistent with how the Founding Fathers would have intended that language, given their knowledge of the current situation. And the conflict then developed with those who were originalists who said, no, it's not a living document. It's a static document, and it needs to be interpreted according to the actual intent of the Founding Fathers when they wrote it. And so that's been a basic conflict in terms of liberal and conservative as to how the Constitution itself is to be interpreted. And were it to continue to be interpreted as a living document, then numbers of the problems that we might face as the result of the conflict between the current reality and the interpretation of the Constitution might be less of a problem.
So Sandy, as we begin to bring this discussion to an end, what do you say to people such as myself who are watching this and really becoming more and more frustrated with this system, and wondering if at some point in time we're going to be able to realize that these changes, there have to be some changes made to it, Sandy. No matter how difficult it is, there have been changes made. But we're coming to a point, especially at this point and at this juncture, that however difficult they may be, we've got to look at it and make some hard decisions.
Well, I think that is true. I mean, my view, I don't know whether I'll live to see it, but I do expect that there will be probably a constitutional convention that will be the result of the issues that have been arising over these past decade in particular. And the issues at a constitutional convention could be just as knotty, and by that I mean K-N-O-T-T-Y,
right,
as they were when the Founding Fathers were butting heads and trying to figure out exactly how to draw up a constitution that would bring to compromise the various views of the Federalists, the states' rights people, and the various ideological views that were then ongoing. So, you know, a new constitutional convention would be the cause of a great debate in this country, I think, over a number of issues: the Electoral College, the notion of one man, one vote, one the Senate, the way the Senate is comprised. I mean, our whole system is the result of a compromise between those with land and money and those who can simply vote because they're an individual, and that whole dispute and that whole discussion would arise again, I think.
You know, Sandy, as you look at the sheer wealth that has been garnered by a small segment of the American people, and this whole other group that really seem to be struggling, and it appears to be no end in sight as the wealthy continue to get wealthier. Something's going to have to take place. And like you said, it may not happen in your or my lifetime, but surely, Sandy, it can't keep going in a positive manner and for what's in the best interest of our nation the way it's constructed now.
Well, I'm not ready to go there, but my sense is that that when I look at what I predict as probable, I think that it is probable that there will be a reopening of the Constitution in some fashion, and I think it's because once the levers of power are exercised by whatever party decides to exercise them, and once they are successfully exercised, the other party in power will feel compelled, if only by the rest of the party, to pull on those same levers and to use them in the same fashion as it's been demonstrated they can be used. And so, sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander, I think, in this kind of a circumstance. And at some point, I think there will develop a greater unanimity that we're headed in the wrong direction and we need to right the ship.
You know, Sandy, with all your grandchildren and great-grandchildren.
I don't have any great-grandchildren.
Oh, but your grandchildren. And you look and you try to look into the future for what the nation and the world is going to look like for them. Are you optimistic or pessimistic as it relates to what's taking place in our government now?
Well, I don't know. I've almost been an optimist because every day for me has been good, and in spite of what's going on around me. And I think that from an evolutionary standpoint, the human race will keep itself on the right track in the long run. Not that we won't have make some serious mistakes
missteps,
along
yeah.
the way, but yeah, I think it's going to be okay.
You know, Sandy, last thing, we began this conversation about the Supreme Court and where it is, and the fact that it, is now seen to be, just something that a paper tiger in some instances. Will we see that, continue, or will we see some balance come back to it?
Well, like I said, once something's demonstrated, I think it's taken us. I think that Andrew Jackson turning his back on the Supreme Court after 1832 and their decision in the Georgia case has had an impact to today. We're almost 200 years down the road. I think that it takes a long time for the governmental processes to recover from or change from the actual experience they have, particularly as it relates to judicial powers. And the powers of Supreme Courts in various countries, in various regimes, is a fragile power. And it's always been fragile in the United States. And in its fragility, I think, is maybe being demonstrated now.
Last thing. So, as you stated, in this last hour or so, the fact that the way our court systems are set up, do we change the way we educate the future children on the system, or do we leave it the way it is, where many of us believe that the Supreme Court has, you know, the total power and control over the levers of our government?
Well, historians are the ones who teach history, and they'll read the leaves, and they'll teach it as they do. Hopefully, we don't get into a process of only teaching revisionist history that has a purpose rather than simply disseminating facts. But I think the Supreme Court has always been viewed as being somewhat limited. But I think that what really relates to it is not what the people think about the Supreme Court. It's what the executive branch and the people residing in the White House think of the Supreme Court and the rule of law.
You know what, my friend, we have to leave it there for now. But, man, always great having these conversations with you. Just to have the opportunity to continue to listen to your wisdom and your knowledge, that continues to, you know, open my eyes to things, and I'm sure many others in this audience, is a pleasure. Until the next time.
Yeah.
Stay warm.
Go Pack.
All right.
Yeah.
Go Bears.
Oh, no. Oh, my God.
All right. That's my good friend Sandy Williams, and that's another wrap of what's going on with Earl Ingram.